You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.
All right. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of our podcast. Today, we have a special guest with us, expert, colleague, and mentor. This gentleman also worked alongside me in the Federal Bureau of Prisons for a while, but today we have Dr. Carl Giacono. Carl, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Good to have you, sir, man. Always a pleasure. So as we're going to have a clinical discussion today, we want to talk about some of the things that are involved with criminal personalities and some of the variants of those, and also some of the underpinnings of those personalities. We'll talk about antisocial personality disorder a little bit. We'll talk about psychopathy as the show goes on today, and we'll see how far we get with that. And then we'll have other shows, other episodes where we continue the material. But without further ado, Carl, kind of tell us a little bit about yourself, your experiences, exposure, jail work, the whole thing. So kind of run through that a little bit.
Yeah, Bruce, when we talked about doing this and talking about a topic like criminal personality or psychopathy, particularly psychopathy is one of the most important constructs in either any type of forensic work, probably in the last 30 to 40 or so years. And we'll get into that a little bit. But it reminded me of kind of the path and the journey I've taken to get the research and the understanding about what we're going to talk about. When I think about it, it kind of flowed in a linear perspective, which each step of my background and training leading to a different interest or a further nuance in understanding the criminal personality. So I begin with kind of working in a county jail and working in the sexual behavior lab at Atascadero State Hospital in California. And my initial things, what I was struck by is these folks, many of the chronic offenders, have a different way of thinking and they view the world quite differently than we do. And that became my first research interest or kind of what I looked for when I was working in these places. In other words, assessing and understanding that. And as you know, and maybe some of your listeners don't know, there was two guys, Jakelson and Samenow, that did their work back at St. Elizabeth's. And they really kind of pioneered this idea of criminal thinking and how people that do chronic offenses or get into trouble chronically have a different way of viewing or seeing the world. So I really immersed myself in studying that, the criminal personality and criminal thinking. But what I noted when I was in the institutional setting at the jail and at Ash is that not only did the criminals have a different way of thinking, but there were certain differences among the criminals. I would later discover that the offenders that were psychopathic were different than the ones that were just antisocial or regular offenders. But I would leave that area, San Luis Obispo area, and go work on my PhD down in San Diego. One of the contributions at that time, there was three major ones, but the two ones is I got to work on an inpatient unit with conduct disordered kids. So this began to round out my perspective of how these disorders start, how people get from point A to B and develop these kind of personalities. I also at that time worked for several agencies, including working at the probation department for juveniles. And we would run groups with criminal thinking with these kids that would come in. So it added to my understanding of the criminal thinking and the personality differences by not only working with little kids that were conduct disordered, but also them working with juveniles at the probation camp. And the final piece of that experience, San Diego, was that I am interviewing people for my doctoral dissertation, which my interest in the criminal personality, and you know well that when you do a dissertation, kind of how you have to do a lit review and so forth, because of my interest in this area, what I would do is every paper, everything in a class, I would do a topic related to the criminal personality. So by the time I got to my dissertation, my lit review was basically done. But one of the things with gathering data for my dissertation, I interviewed people called psychopaths, as delineated by the PCLR. And I began to look at differences between psychopaths and non-psychopaths. I also think I first interviewed two sexual homicide perpetrators, which would become then an interest. So I would leave San Diego and working in those groups, and I'd go back to Atascadero State Hospital. And eventually at ASH, this was from my postdoctoral hours, eventually at ASH, I was the assessment center director, which means any difficult case or anybody that came in the institution that was some sort of severe problem, I would assess. So I had people come in, the psychiatrist said, Carl, this guy's sexually attracted to automobiles. What's that about? But I interviewed every sexual homicide perpetrator, every serial killer, every malinger, and every psychopath. So what I began to do there is follow this path of learning about the more severe conditions that were related to psychopathy, starting with criminal thinking in general, going through developmental theories, working with these folks, and then ending up kind of with studying serial killers, sexual homicide perpetrators, and so forth. So it was kind of, Bruce, it was a real natural transition. And basically when I went to the BOP, the Bureau of Prisons, and worked with the Department of Justice, which you and I worked there together, basically at that point it was running programs, teaching staff, and new learning wasn't really forthcoming, but it was putting some of these things I had learned into practice.
So let me jump in there. That's good. Now, folks, what Dr. Jacono is going to be talking about these concepts, but let me tell each and every one of you that these concepts are used in what the BOP now uses is the pattern risk assessment. So there's something out there that the BOP uses, Carl, that has static and dynamic risk factors borrowed from the literature, yourself and others, as well as the risk needs responsivity model.
Cool.
Even the Good Lives model, Tony Ward and others in the sex offender space. So what we're going to be talking about are some of the things that people are going to be having to deal with in terms of how the Bureau evaluates their risk. Those individuals that are serving sentences that are medium and high risk aren't able to earn the First Step Act time off credits. Individuals that either score down or earn their way down or possess a lower minimum risk on the pattern measure are eligible for First Step Act time credits. Now that's not gonna, but today we're not gonna talk about the time credits, we're gonna talk about the psychology behind that measurement in grave detail, in probably more detail you'd ever want to know, but at least you'll hear the grave detail from the psychological underpinning. So again, yeah, another thing I want to underscore, Dr. Jacono was at the Federal Medical Center, Fort Worth, Texas. He was there when I was at the Federal Medical Center, Carville, Louisiana. We were colleagues and allies and going to trainings and those things together in 1993. I then go to the Federal Medical Center, Carswell, 1994. Dr. Jacono still at Fort Worth. And then he transitions over to become the chief psychologist at FCI Bastrop, which is near Austin, Texas. Bastrop is a low-security institution with a satellite camp attached, and Carl was the chief psychologist there. And so again, all that you're going to hear a bunch of psychological stuff, but a lot of this is born out of our not only our academic and our clinical experiences, but also our experiences inside the Bureau of Prisons. So. Anyway, Carl, I just wanted to get that context there.
Yeah, cool, Bruce. What I hear you saying is the BOP's been able to use this data and this scientific stuff objectively in a practical way, which is the way it should be.
That is correct. It's finally happening. But the BOP only gets some credit. I believe it was the National Institute of Justice that really put this together, obviously, because there were a lot of researchers, doctoral level folks, such as yourselves and others and beyond, that really put this together in a meaningful way. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's so essential that we just don't rely on kind of gut feelings as psychologists.
Correct.
When we have this empirical data out there. So that's really good to hear they're doing that. You know, for example, one time at the BOP, this guy was a problem and they had me to assess him and he was high on psychopathy. And I said, you need to watch him closely. He's at higher risk for escape, so forth. 3-4 months later, he escaped from the institution. So, I mean, we have things as psychologists that people don't always hear about that can be used to kind of predict certain treatment outcomes as well as things related to institutional misconduct.
Yeah.
And reoffense rates, of course.
Yeah. So yeah, so there's all that is kind of encompassing, and it's great that we now live in a day and age that this is kind of the ordinary. These are now ordinary things that are part of every case. Every case manager negotiates these things. Every inmate takes surveys through psychology now. And so this is part of a mainstay. It's a staple of the federal prison experience. And so I'm just going to flash by my ideal of, real quick. Texas A&M undergraduate in psychology, went to the, I worked a year at the Austin State Hospital, another ASH, Austin State Hospital,
yeah,
mental hospital.
I remember it.
Yes, sir. Right there on Guadalupe. I was there, lived near Hyde Park at the time. And anyway, from there, I went to graduate school in Wyoming, studied clinical psychology. From there, I was recruited by the Federal Bureau of Prisons to open up the first sex offender treatment unit in 1990. And I was also recruited dually to open the first of three RDAP programs in 1990. So it was an interesting time. And then from there, I went to Louisiana, to Texas, and then to the regional office. So anyway, just a little bit...
if you take what you're saying a little further, Bruce, the inference is that for both of us, we've had a lot of clinical experience working with folks, but we've also read and done research as well, which gives you a unique perspective. I remember in 1995, I was invited by NATO to present in Alvor, Portugal. This was the days when sometimes NATO had money for kind of scientific pursuits when there were less wars and conflicts going on. I was probably one out of, I think, three or four psychologists from the U.S. that presented my data. But some of that stuff was the beginnings of kind of applying this within institutional settings. I remember even at Atascadero State Hospital, I worked there, for instance. When I first got there, they didn't want to talk about institutional violence and dangerousness. They didn't often want custody officers going up on the units because they thought it wasn't therapeutic, which, of course, is not true. And there was one staff murdered at Atascadero, another was strangled from behind, and another was slashed with a knife. And at that point, I was promoted and going around the state hospital system in California, training people about institutional risk. We're very concerned about this because when you work in an institutional setting, your patients are non-psychopathic offenders are often likely to be victimized by some of these individuals. And not only that, these individuals can kind of disrupt the treatment for the people that can benefit from treatment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, all right. So let's go with, I guess, the underpinnings with criminal thinking and dynamics in children and treat, kind of work our way. If you want to do that, Carl, work our way
okay.
up through. Yeah.
Well, as a basic core, what you think about with not every criminal, but many of them, is kind of having a personality disorder. Because antisocial personality disorder, which is mainly behavioral, is a personality disorder. And other disorders like histrionic disorder, we often find with female offenders. Narcissistic personality disorders, we often find with male offenders. But you'll see these dynamics in little kids of the narcissism. Narcissism, basically the idea that people do not have a stable self-conscience or sense of self. On one hand, they have an aspect that's grandiose with a lot of unrealistic self-appraisal skills. It influences the way they see others. Within that is kind of feelings of emptiness and worthlessness. So you have these two, which most of us, we can experience being down, a little depressed. We're not always at the top of our game, but we usually don't crash into a pit of emptiness. Where Jakobson and Samenow called this the zero state, this right. kind of feeling of worthlessness and emptiness. And you'll see this in the little kids. You'll see their personality structure in their figure drawings, their testing, their play therapy. It vacillates between these extremes. Now, in the little kids, if you get them in time, sometimes your work with them, they can integrate those two things and be more stable. But when you think about criminal thinking in the adults, a lot of the criminal thinking has to do with maintaining that grandiosity and keeping that kind of as the organizing principle in an otherwise unstable personality. So when you work with an offender and you deal with their thinking that is usually self-centered, kind of not considering the impact of their behavior on others and so forth, when you work with that and they begin to take responsibility and shape some of their criminal thinking, they'll often go through periods where they're feeling emptiness or really down, which is time when you need to be supported. But this instability in their personality makes it difficult for them to have empathy or kind of put themselves in someone else's shoes. It often gives them feelings of entitlement, that they feel justified in doing things to other people or stealing. You know, they may have no thoughts or anything about that, or compassion or understanding for others. The run-of-the-mill offender will have periods of kind of feeling things towards others and more normal kind of states, but it doesn't last and it's not stable. The psychopaths generally don't have that at all. They're pretty much consistently without empathy, without things like remorse and so forth. And the thinking justifies their kind of behaviors. In other words, they may do something to someone and in their mind, well, they have that coming, or something happened to me, so therefore, you know. Or one psychopath told me in his thinking about another person's property, he said to me, "Doc," he said, "it's like this." He said, "That stuff, anything you have, your car, your possessions, they're really mine, but they're on loan to you." But see, that's a severe psychopath. And most of the offenders, of course, are not.
Right.
But the idea is the same. In order for people to change, they have to begin to think differently. For example, an offender gets out of the institution, and whereas he would have went across the street on the red light, now what he does is he thinks to himself, "Wait a minute, I have to follow the rules. I can't go across the street in a red light. When I start bending the rules, I don't have control and I don't know when it's going to stop. First I'm taking a little thing, then I'm taking something bigger, and it begins to get out of control. So I have to be vigilant about my behavior and actions and thinking, and I have to curtail them at the very beginning, at least for a few years, or until normal thinking or more responsible thinking is integrated." So the idea of criminal thinking is really just the idea. It's the cognitive or thinking part of the underlying personality.
Right. Yeah. And so we talk about in risk, you know, violating the boundaries of others. And that could be in a lot of different ways, right? That can be a property crime. I had my guys would say, you know, "That's why you have insurance, Mr.
There
Cameron,
you go.
Because, hey, you know what? That guy really didn't want his car anyway. He left the keys in the ignition."
Yes.
I mean, come on.
See?
Freaking key. See what I mean? Yes. So I know I've had those guys, we all have, right, that have worked in these institutions, and we always have these rationalizations and justifications
there you
for
go.
These actions to try to pencil whip it and make it seem like, or I had to do what I had to do by any means necessary to survive because I was in the hood or the project. No, because there's other people that grow up just as rough, just as hard, and they're not in jail. They're not in prison. So what does that mean about you? And so, you know, our job was constantly to bring back to the client, hey, let's talk about you. Let's talk about your issues, your freedom. You want to stay free. And a lot of inmates will want to stay free. You know, and
that's it, Bruce. See, now you got it. When you work in that kind of treatment, you're not laying something on somebody saying they need to be this way. You're saying, look, you got two directions to go. You keep going this way and you're back in prison and jail. Do you want to go this other way? If you want to go this other way, let's talk about it, work on it. And that gives you permission to begin to help train them in thinking differently about every situation. And you said guys, but you know, the cognitive style applies to the gals too. So they both, regardless of gender, have that in common. That thinking that has to do with entitlement, failure to take responsibility for actions, and any thinking that one can correlate or you know, associate with those kind of attributes.
Right. And so in the parlance of these things, there's this developmental progression in it. And it may start as a child as an oppositional defiant disorder. Nowadays, we have kids that are ADD, ADHD, on the spectrum, whatever. But again, if this child is violating people's boundaries, physical boundaries, stealing, whatever, that could be a problem. And then if that oppositional defiance doesn't get treated, it can turn into something called a conduct disorder. The child is a little bit older, maybe a teenager, stealing cars, using alcohol and drugs, being irresponsible with money, this just a lot of other fleeting things, getting in fights, getting in disruptive stuff. And if that goes kind of unfettered, if you will, the person can then develop
An antisocial personality disorder.
Right. And the reason we say personality, I want to be real clear, folks, because we're going from a child to an adolescent to an adult. Really, the personality, we don't diagnose, and I see this, and I know you do too. I see people misdiagnose children with a personality disorder on axis two when you can't do that. The personality disorder is really designated for the adult person. That now their personality is of such a way that it's virtually an unchangeable construct, like mental retardation in the axis two kind of sense.
Yes.
So now they're just going to have to manage their behavior. Now, that doesn't mean that the axis two character disorder can't change. It just means that they're going to have to monitor and be very vigilant and mindful for the rest of their life to be.
By the time you're an adult with these kind of issues, your functioning is pretty set in the sense that the way you think, the way you behave, problems with anger, all these things are very related and integral to the way the personality functions. It's kind of like if most of us kind of are normal neurotic, we have anxiety, we have our ups and downs and so forth. But if earlier in life, like adolescence, instead of dealing with those things, continuing to do responsible things, if we retreat it into substance abuse, alcohol abuse, and so forth, then our personality kinds to get stunted rather than taking a natural evolution. If we choose to confront these kind of things early on, they don't become a pattern potentially. And for most of us, then we change and can go a different route. But it's kind of like the more you kind of continue without moderation of these factors, the more ingrained it becomes.
Right. It becomes a lifestyle for many. And then, you know, the way things are now, I mean, if you have a sustained pattern of criminal behavior, it's not if you're going to get caught, it's just when.
And there's often, they're usually caught for many less things than they do. I remember doing an adult group at the BOP, and we used to start out with that. How many of you, what did you do to get in here? Blah, blah, blah. And of course, initially all of them say, well, you know, I really didn't do that. I didn't do this. One guy saw me, he says, yeah, you know, I didn't do that. I was down the road ripping off a liquor store at the time. But the thing I would say to him, okay, guys, I understand. I hear what you're saying. But here's the deal. If you guys got caught and sentenced for everything you did, you come back in the next lifetime in a little crib with jailhouse blues on. And then they'd laugh and you use humor. And then you begin to get into, look, this is what I have to offer. This is what you need to do. Now, you can either go this way and continue with prison, or you can try this way. And one of the things for people who are antisocial and criminal that often hook them is that when you can point out to them that when they get into fights and anger and do things with no control, they just go from kind of a thought, maybe not a thought, to a behavior, they don't have control over themselves. And the majority of these people in the institutions, that's one thing they don't want to not have. In other words, they want to be in control of every circumstance. So if you can show diagrams and talk about their personality and point out to them how really when they're doing this thing, they're getting into fights because someone stepped on their foot versus they're choosing to get into the fight, that piques their interest somewhat.
I always said installing a thought filter. You know, somebody says something bad about your mama, that doesn't mean you got to kick his ass immediately. And so we do this thought filter. And so I would use terms like thought filter. I would use things like problem solving. Problem solving, right? It's a very non-threatening title because we got to learn how to solve these types of problems that don't result in subsequent arrests and convictions and those things. And so I think, took me many years to kind of figure that out. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
To kind of sell it, you know? And
yes. You need creative ways of selling it, Bruce. You got to be able to talk to them kind of at their level and give them something they want. It's no different than other sales. Most people here that have these issues don't like the lack of control. They don't like the idea when you get them in a sincere moment. Now, this isn't the psychopaths. This is most of the offenders, though, is that when you talk to them and get them in a moment where they're being honest, you know, I really did that to my family. And I did that out of, and you know what? I kind of wish I wouldn't have done that. So the non-psychopaths will have examples that you can use to demonstrate that.
Right. I think one of the things that we'll be going back to again and again and again is to show that there's a difference between folks that are offenders that aren't callous and can experience remorse and true guilt and empathy toward others versus the other folks that really can't. They just don't do that.
In the old days, the stats were that most of the prison population, probably for males, only about 25% or so were psychopathic. That means you have a range of other people with different kinds of issues, many of which can be worked with.
Exactly. One of my favorite items, I know it kind of loads up on probably the second factor of psychopathy, but or hopefully not the first, but if you were convicted of six or more different types of crimes, you remember that?
Oh, before? Yeah. Yeah, criminal versatility.
Yeah, thank you. There it is. And that, to me, that's a bridge. This is Bruce Cameron here talking, not Carl, but that's kind of a bridge. Like, wow, this guy's actually done six different categorical crimes that he's been convicted for on record, NCIC, and does that mean he's a psychopath? No, it doesn't mean he's a psychopath. You can still be criminally versatile and still have empathy, but I always was interested in that bridge. Go ahead.
Yes. Well, think about logically, Bruce. You got a guy here, and I evaluate this guy on an outpatient basis when I was working in private practice. It was for a parole assessment. He, every time he got into a fight, he was in a barn drunk. And he's non-psychopathic. So logically, what do? You give him substance abuse treatment, something so he stops drinking, and keep him out of bars. And yeah, he's not going to have a wonderful life, and it's going to be perfect. But some cases are real clear cut like that. And when you look at the violence and the risk potential, it's a circumstance. It has to do with alcohol or substances, and they're not psychopathic, which means they have some redeemable things you can work with. And a lot of risk assessment and thinking about who's going to offend and who's not can be broken down in those kind of terms. Looking at, right. And then there's different kinds of violence. When you mentioned about the criminal versatility and the one exception is sex offenders. They can have 5,000 child molestations, and they may or may not be amenable to treatment, and they may not have a variety of offenses. But otherwise, for the run-of-the-mill offender, yeah, they may have a bunch of different types of offenses, and it doesn't necessarily mean they're psychopathic.
I think, Carl, another thing that people are struggling and arguing with the BOP about is that if there's, they may be, let's say they're in for a drug charge, but there's documented history of violence, prior convictions, domestic violence, whatever, robbery, armed robbery, and all this other stuff. And let's say the conduct was 10, 15 years ago. They'll say, well, that's not fair. You're judging me. You're calculating my risk. And I'm just here as a drug offender on a basic cocaine conspiracy for not even a kilogram, and yet you're judging me by all these other risk factors. Like, well, yeah, they are.
Yes.
It's documented. If it's documented past conduct, then it counts.
You're assessing more than just the offense or one behavior, assessing the personality. So all those things you're talking about are important to determining risk, treatability, and the kind of issues that you have when you're working in an institutional setting.
Absolutely. So, and again, it's pretty interesting because present day, you're in private practice. I'm in private practice. My risk assessment acumen in Texas, I have a license to do this specifically for sexual offenders. So I have a LSOTP license. Texas do that. So I do these very sex offender specific, risk evaluations. We look at the same risk elements that Dr. Jacono would in North Carolina with a patient doing a risk assessment, but ours are a little bit more. There's a few more extra measures on the sexual boundary violations that the other things have. And so, again, this is something that he and I deal with even in our present lives. This is not a retrospect in the good old days. This is still very much
and Bruce,
alive
and
well.
Technically, I've retired, and I just do my consulting work through Maverick Psychology. So what I do is I advise people like you on specific cases. But I don't do direct clinical work anymore, forensic work.
Oh, really? I thought you talked direct folks. Well, I'll be calling you for some advice, Carl, for sure.
Definitely. Or talk about old times at the BOP.
There you go. But so, the BOP and any institution has a hybrid, just a lot of different types of people in institutions. You know, just because somebody's in a federal prison camp doesn't mean that they're all low risk. I mean, from time to time, you'll get a penitentiary inmate that has scored his way down after 15 or 20 years, and he's going to release out of camp. And so he may have some other personality issues, but he was able to work his way down to a lower security institution.
And he may have other issues that are specific kind of to risk assessment. For example, Bruce, you know, we might look at someone who only does affective violence, which is emotional impulsive violence, versus someone that does predatory violence. For your viewers, they can think about a cat. When you see that cat stalking prey, no emotion, planned after a mouse, that's consistent with predatory violence. Versus you frighten the cat, it gets the hunchback and hissed. So sometimes psychotic people will have a lot of incidents of affective violence where they're scared or something's going on, attack rather than be attacked. And medications and other techniques may work with them. But the psychopaths usually have at least some of the idea of the predatory violence, planned, purposeful. But you can have a combination of someone who actually has a psychosis and also psychopathic. So this is where the psychologist and the diagnostic ferreting out becomes essential.
Right. Let's stop the buzz here and talk about real quick. When we talk about psychotic psychosis, we're talking about a major thought disorder, a disorder in thinking where sometimes people are hallucinating. They may have delusions of grandeur or persecution or other kind of sensory things. And Dr. Jacono, how else would you describe psychotic behavior?
Psychotic people are delusional. They may have false beliefs, usually impaired reality testing, where they're not seeing the world even like personality disorders because they're hearing voices and other things are kind of influencing their thinking. So the two big categories we usually see are usually a manic depressive, which is kind of an extreme impairment in moods that's biological, or they're hearing voices not related to organic things or substance abuse, but it's kind of a biological condition. And you can say the same way with the others. These are usually things that there's a genetic history in the family sort of thing.
Right. Right. And again, we'll revisit this, but this is going to date the show, but this is current and present day is the Rob Reiner case. Rob Reiner and his wife were stabbed to death by their son. The press has lined this out as kind of a, I think they're trying to set him up as a not guilty by reason of insanity. But again, that now they're mentioning schizophrenia now and some other stuff to kind of paint that portrait. And so, again, I think that Rob Reiner case will be an interesting case to follow.
Yes. Because you can be psychotic and still have understood your behavior and what you were doing. But often with people that are not guilty by reason of insanity, there's often some psychosis or something like that involved.
Right. Did you have a mental disease or defect at the time of the commission of the instant offense that renders you, I think that's the last part of it, that renders you unable to be able to have purposeful things? But some of these things are purposeful. Some of these things are goal-directed. Some of these things were planned.
Well, I remember a guy on the unit at Ash at Tascadero where he stabbed a guy in the head with a pencil after a kind of he didn't like what he said in a group. Now, this guy was psychotic, but when he did that, psychosis had nothing to do with it. It was his personality disorder, and he was just pissed off and offended. So, these are the things that good assessors and psychologists have to ferret out when asked about legal kind of issues like incompetency or insanity.
And dangerousness. Right.
Sure.
And, is another one. So 42, 46. Now, you did some forensic evals over there, didn't you, over there at Fort Worth, a couple?
You know, I did a lot of them at Ash. I did some regular evals at Fort Worth in that.
Okay.
But then in private practice, that's what I did. I had a regular practice of regular psychotherapy with people, and then I did forensic evals, paroles assessments, and things like that. Basically, any of the work with the attorneys. Right. I mean, even attorneys would ask me about is this client going to be a good person to have on the stand? So you really get in the position of evaluating anything where information that's useful to the courts or the attorney is kind of, you know, that's what you're paid to do.
And one of the things that I had particular experience and expertise in the bureau was the competency. Okay,
is
the person competent? Are they competent to go to trial? Do they, in other words, do they know what the charges are? Do they know what their pleading options are? Are they able to assist in their own offense with an attorney? And then, so some people that may be psychotic or have some other thing going, they can't even participate in the court process. And so what we would say is, hey, this person's not competent. Now, in the Federal Bureau of Prisons, as some of you know, that means you still stay in prison, and they will do what's called a 4241D, which is a competency restoration. So you're going to be medicated or whatever, or sent to another unit or whatever, until such a time you're competent. And so...
Yeah, and Bruce, and with the state system in California, when I lived there, and it's been quite a while, the same kind of thing.
Right.
People at Atascadero came in as those commitments incompetent. And besides the medication and stability, you spend a lot of times in group teaching them about the court proceedings, how you need to behave, mm-hmm. what were your charges, what are the sentence possibilities. And you went through the whole gamut to indicate and teach them an understanding of what they were facing in the legal proceedings. Right.
Exactly. And so that's just another element to this where, you know, we're not looking at, well, we are looking at personality and risk and those things, but gosh, the person's just there and they need to get through the process and they need to be charged or and or convicted or whatever. And so sometimes we have mental health issues that we have to deal with on the very early front end in order to get to a clear picture about character and future risk and those things. We just got to get them through the initial process and through that mental health hump.
Where most of the things probably that folks would be dealing with, that many of your viewers are people that have already been found guilty and incarcerated, dealing with their treatment, their release, things like that. You're talking about the element of the criminal justice system that kind of deals with stuff on the front end.
Yeah. Right. That is true. And so the Bureau of Prisons does a front, middle, and a halfway house home confinement toward the end. So it's a very interesting agency. And then, of course, a lot of the our offenders transition into federal supervision for 2, 3, 4, 5 years plus, depending on the judgment, commitment order, and whatever else. And then probation. Probation has their own risk to it.
Well, that's beautiful because, you know, when you're in the institution, you're teaching these things and helping people with the change process. When you get out, there's all kinds of stressors you don't have when you're in the institutional setting. So generally, follow-up treatment will increase the likelihood the person doesn't reoffend because they're going to need support. They're going to need help in the community. It's kind of essential. Programs that just do the work inside the institution, then goodbye when they go out the door. Statistically, there's no support for that being superior to following people and offering help.
So that's why when their loved ones or whatever, they go to psychology, they take these surveys, somebody might have antisocial peers go into class for that. Some of the people may have a family deficit or other types of issues.
And substance abuse, alcohol abuse, go to AA, go to NA. Yeah.
Right. So we have, in theory, you know, different classes to address those needs that are identified, which would then reduce risk, which would then produce hopefully a person that never goes back into the criminal justice system, and I think that's good that we have that focus.
That's everybody's goal. So everybody's goal is not to have them reoffend again, and families and inmates is not to go back.
So I got a question for Dr. Giacono. You know, you hear the terms psychopath and sociopath used almost interchangeably, and you and I know that's not correct.
Yes.
Dr. Giacono, please tell us the difference between the sociopath and the psychopath.
Well, it's kind of simple. If you think of the word sociopath, that was one used in the first DSM in like 1952. Yep. And I think in the DSM is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. It's our guide in psychiatry and psychology for offering diagnoses, which are offered in order to inform treatment. So anyway, I think in the 60s, might have been 64. Now, these are numbers I'm not going to. The word antisocial personality disorder was used. And that pretty much then stayed with the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. But if you look at this, The antisocial personality disorder criteria are mainly behavioral. So you get like 75% of an adult institution, people have that diagnosis. In conduct disorder would be the juvenile equivalent. You may have 65%. Women may be a little less, but the bottom line is there's a high percentage of people that are in institutions that get the diagnosis. And it mainly assesses someone that's getting in trouble with the law, impulsive. And that's, you know, there's some more things, but that's the basic idea. Now, the importance of understanding the diagnosis is because they're not all the same. Here's an example of two people I interviewed for my doctoral research that were both antisocial personality disorder. The one guy that comes in is hardly makes eye contact. And, you know, looks kind of a weak handshake, kind of is very polite and respectful. But he has the history of antisocial personality disorder since adolescence and so forth, getting in trouble, violating rights. Here's another guy that comes in during the interview. He sits down on the table, props his feet up and says, "Hey, Don," he says, "Carl, you can call me Don." So he comes in, he takes over the room. Now remember, he's in a professional setting. Rather than Dr. Giacomo, Dr. Carl, we're on first name basis. Now, both these people would meet the criteria for antisocial personality disorder, but the second one, when assessed with the Harris Psychopathy Checklist, would also be a psychopath. And what you see in his behavior is the grandiosity. I mean, you know, no boundaries. He's taking control of the situation. He's devaluing me. So, yeah, that's the importance of psychopathy, which tends to, the way to think about it is most psychopaths also have the criteria for antisocial personality, but most antisocial personality disorders are not psychopathic. So the antisocial is primarily behavior, and the juvenile equivalent is conduct disorder. And it basically has to do with some. I'm sorry, go ahead, Bruce.
But the sociopath is more defined by...
No, it's an irrelevant concept. See, it went out with the second DSM. Although people who don't like to say the word psychopath because they think it's nasty will use the word sociopathy. But it really, it doesn't have a meaning anymore.
No, but I bring that, Carl, I'm bringing this up.
Yeah.
I don't know what media, but I hear that all.
Yes. Yes, you do.
Every show, every Dateline, every this, every that, sociopath, and they're actually trying to say psychopath.
Right.
It's incorrect. I just wanted to draw distinction. I want to draw that distinction to our listeners that, hey, that's an older construct.
There you go.
Social personality disorder encompasses the behavior, but the psychopath has the antisocial with the added callousness and remorselessness and other things that will...
So
that
the way to think of the psychopath... With an antisocial person, you can have all kinds of other personality disorders, and you think of the antisocial personality as just the behaviors. You can have an avoidant. You can have someone that has X, Y, and Z. You can have paranoid. You can have this and that. But with a psychopath in males, it tends to correlate with antisocial personality disorder and narcissistic personality disorder. So you have both, which means you have those character traits with narcissism, and you have the behavioral problems. And in females, it tends to correlate more strongly with histrionic and borderline personality and then antisocial. So with the female psychopath, you also have a personality disorder like a histrionic and the behavioral problem.
For those of you who are interested or in graduate school, the cluster B, antisocial.
There you go.
The cluster B area of character disorder are kind of right there as fundamental aspects of the antisocial personality disorder, and of course, the psychopath. So, if you are interested in the different clusters, that cluster B is kind of the nexus, if you will, where some of this stuff is at. Now, we're down under 5 minutes, Dr. Giacomo. I told you this would fly by. So, but we're gonna be doing a series on this. So, again. Just a quick rundown. What separates the offender groups, I guess? You want to do that?
You mean related to psychopathy, Bruce?
Sure. Or? Yeah. Related to psychopathy.
Okay, well, generally the ones that are going to be psychopathic, which kind of, as we've discussed here, usually have this narcissistic disorder in males and histrionic disorder in females, as well as antisocial personality. They tend to not benefit from treatment. Now, this is group data, so there's always individual differences. They're more likely to drop out of treatment early, fail treatment. When they get into the community, they're more likely to reoffend, perhaps more likely to reoffend violently. They tend to have more misconducts within the institution. See, if you were a police officer dealing with this, these are the people you would have on a high risk, or a probation officer. You'd have them on a high risk structured kind of supervision or watch. So it's a way of kind of narrowing down empirically that these particular people we need to be extra cautious around and pay attention to. Right. So that's really the benefit of that. With a run-of-the-mill antisocial person, you can have a psychopath, but there's also a lot of non-psychopathic people among that group.
Right. I was doing some research on female psychopathy at Carswell. One of my variables was called days in the hole, days cool. of segregation. Man, did that show a positive yeah. relationship? The more days in the hole, the more psychopathic they were, regardless if it was administrative detention versus disciplinary segregation. Yes. Good God, that was such a robust.
Yeah, Bruce.
It really doesn't. But anyway, but that's kind of moving out into the institution. That's moving. That's not.
Yeah. Proactive. Well, we did a research article we have published on that. Jason Smith, it's listed in our book on understanding female offenders, which has chapters right. on female psychopaths. And that's exactly what we found. The female psychopaths had many more misconducts, I guess is what they called the ones that he looked yeah. at. Incidents, yeah. reports of all kinds in the institution, because mm-hmm. they're different. Mm-hmm. And staff mm-hmm. needs to be aware of it because you approach them differently.
But it is good to see that the thing that does hold is the misconduct itself inside the yes. confines of an institution. To be able to do that against the prohibition of the system, or the, you know, against parental prohibition as a child, against prohibition of the, you know, obeying the rules of the institution, I mean, it says a lot. So when you,
yeah.
when you
transgress an awful lot, against, Bruce.
Yeah, and when you transgress against that a lot, and that's why we ask our clients and some folks have watched the show. Does your loved one have clear conduct? Do they have any 100 or 200 level incident reports at the last couple of years, et cetera, to see if this person's a rule follower or not a rule follower? That could have ramifications for risk and then, of course, early release placement. So this is yeah. kind of the stuff that we're born out of. I know we have 2 minutes left. And on our next episode, next time we meet with Dr. Jacona, we're going to talk about the PCLR. We're going to talk the psychopathy checklist and how this is measured, how it's measured in a very scientific way. And there's a lot of research now that really supports the PCLR. And then there's other psychopathic instruments out now, but definitely we want to go back to
The PCLR and the family of those are the only reliable and valid ones for assessing psychopathy. Some of the other ones correlate with antisocial personality disorder and, quite frankly, are meaningless. But the PCLR itself is the only valid measure. And then they have a youth version that's also right. valid. So it's the only one where you can say if they score high that this is somebody that falls within a psychopathic range.
Right. So that's it, folks. That's a wrap. We're coming up on 1 minute. Thanks so much for tuning in today. You can see this show on Apple Podcasts and several Amazon Audible. And, of course, on LA Talk Radio, our home station here. You can always get these episodes for free. You can get the MP4 video. You could get the MP3 sound. So we really appreciate you tuning in today. We hope you found this part of the discussion interesting. We're going to continue on the discussion with the PCLR and some other things, differences between males and females, and other differential behaviors and traits. So as we continue to understand this phenomenon, that's very important. So with that, we'll bid everybody farewell. Have a great day. Dr. Jacona, thanks for coming on.
Hey, thanks, Bruce.
Next time. All right.
Yeah, see you next time.
Take care, everybody. Have a great week. Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.